Welcome back to Tales from a Bibliophile, a podcast about all things reading and the communities that books create. I'm your host, Carly Galorn Stewart, and this week it's just me again. So it's a solo episode again this week. Summer's a little busy. It's hard to kind of schedule guests. And so there's a few more solo episodes during the summer months. Speaking of being busy, I took a couple of weeks, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I'm not really sure. Maybe not even that many, but either way, I took a break. There was definitely no podcast episode last week, so if you are still here, thank you. I apologize for my somewhat irregular recording habits. This podcast is purely for fun. It is a hobby of mine, and so sometimes when life gets busy, this show gets put on the back burner. And that is what happened. It is summer reading in the land of libraries, and I got a little bit overwhelmed. We are incredibly busy at my library, and also have been dealing with a sort of a lot of stress at work. I'll just put it that way. We're kind of in the middle of something, so I don't really want to share too many details, but there's been a fair bit more stress than usual, and so between that and just the general busyness of life and of work, I took a bit of a break. I had planned on honestly taking all of July off as a break, but I took a few weeks off and I missed it, so I'm back. So this week, it's going to just be me, and then next week, hopefully, if everything goes according to plan, we'll be back with a guest. I'm not going to tell you who it is in case it doesn't go according to plan, but hopefully we'll be back with some interesting guests soon. I know Erica and Britton both will be joining me again soon. But for today's episode, we're going to talk about my summer reading roundup. I'm going to try to start doing these either solo or with someone like Erica. I'm going to try to start doing these roundups more regularly, possibly monthly, depending on the schedule. But I want to talk about what I've been reading. And I've been reading a fair bit. I feel like I'm getting back into the groove with reading. This first part of the year was a little slow for me. I'm not going to talk about that too much just because I think Erica or someone is going to come on soon and do a sort of mid-year reading roundup episode where we talk about kind of how our reading life has looked this year and our goals and our favorite books of the year so far, that sort of thing. But I want to start doing little mini monthly roundups to talk about any books that I've like been really loving or really hating. Probably not really hating, because I tend to stop reading a book if I'm really hating it, but I might have a few rants up my sleeve every now and then. But for today's episode, I can do summer reading roundup part one. So I'm going to talk about what I've been reading so far this summer, and then maybe at the end of next month I'll do part two, podcast business before I get too caught up in the episode. I am going to be scaling back a little in what I do outside of recording the episodes. So I've tried a little bit playing around with Substack and doing like a weekly thing, newsletter, monthly newsletter sort of thing. And I have too much on my plate, and that's not what I love doing. So as much as I love writing, that particular aspect of the podcast is not going to continue. I am going to keep up the Instagram just because it's the easiest way to have a website right now. So you can still find everything on the Instagram, and that's just Tales from a Bibliophile, or at Tales from a Bibliophile. And anything we are doing will stay linked there. I don't know if I have it on the link tree. I'll make sure it's updated, but I have a code for, or like a, it's not really a code. I have some way to share with you a discount for Book of the Month and for Libro FM, which does audiobooks. I don't always super promote Book of the Month because I would prefer to promote my local bookshop, Avid Bookshops. They do a similar like subscription program, and I think that it is a better way to spend your money if you have that much money to spare. And if you don't, then I don't know. I have mixed feelings on Book of the Month. We don't need to take the whole podcast episode to talk about it. But either way, if you like the idea of Book of the Month, you can choose. If you choose to spend your money there, I have a referral link. If you choose instead to support an independent bookstore and you do not have one who offers a subscription program or one where you prefer to spend your money, Avid Bookshop in Athens, Georgia has a great subscription program that is run by a real person. You're not picking from the same 5 books that everybody else is picking from. You get more personalized selections and your money goes towards an independent bookshop. So anyways, that got off topic. I will make sure that the Instagram link tree is updated with anything we are going to continue doing, but Substack and newsletters are not going to be one of those things. I will post on the Instagram when there is a new episode, so that is the easiest way to find out other than checking your podcast feed. I try really hard to keep this podcast weekly, but sometimes life gets in the way and it goes a week or two without an episode. Truly the easiest, very simplest way, most simple way to keep up with new episodes is to subscribe. So I'm gonna take a minute to say please like/subscribe to the podcast on whatever podcast listening app you use. We are on Spotify and Apple and whatever other ones there are, but those two for sure. I don't know if you can leave reviews on Spotify, but I know you can on Apple, so go ahead and drop one of those on there. And I'm gonna stop rambling about podcast business now because we're almost 10 minutes in and we haven't really talked about books. So I'm gonna jump into, this is what happens when I record solo. There's no one to counteract my rambling. But before I jump into what I've already read and finished this summer, before I jump into our summer reading roundup, I'm gonna talk a little bit about what I've been reading. I love doing that. And I am reading 3 separate books, which would probably be a surprise to no one who knows me. 2 of them are for the podcast, and one of them is just because I wanted to. So the first one is Sabrina and Karina by, I meant to look this up before I jumped on so that I pronounced it correctly, but Callie Fajardo Anstein. It's probably very wrong, but Sabrina and Karina is the title. You can find it that way. If you can't understand my butchered pronunciation of their last name. It is a debut story collection on friendships, mothers and daughters, and the deep-rooted truths of our homelands centered on the Latinas of indigenous ancestry that shines a new light on the American West. It is great so far. I have listened to 2 of the stories. I'm listening to it on audio, which is one, just the way I like to do books if they are, if they have any other separate language besides English, which includes fantasy novels with made up languages. I like knowing how it was intended to be pronounced. And so this one has not a ton, but a little bit of Spanish in it. I like hearing the proper pronunciation of things. And so, and I've been on an audio kick lately. So I've been doing Sabrina and Karina that way. Normally with a short story collection, I prefer to read 1 story a day so I can kind of separate them out, but this is a audiobook and I only have a certain amount of time with it, and so I am just listening to it altogether. I'm not taking the separate days in between as I usually do with a short story collection. So the other 2 I am reading are 4 future podcast episodes. On paper, in physical format, I am reading Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. This is a reread for me. I read this when it first came out. I actually did the audio when it first came out, and I really liked the audio, but now that I'm reading the paper copy, I like that better. I'm actually really surprised with myself that I was able to do the audio for this book because there are a lot of narrators. It's like an oral history of it's a made up oral history of a made up band, but it is told in interview style, and all of the members of the band and some other people are interviewed. And so like every other paragraph is a new person and there are like 10 people. So I have no idea how I did this in audio, but I'm enjoying it on paper. I've always liked Taylor Jenkins Reid. I think her work is looking at her work is fascinating because she wrote these first four novels and then shifted when she came out with Evelyn Hugo into this new style, this new format. With Evelyn Hugo's and Daisy Jones, she does sort of an oral history interview style format where she tells the story that way. And so it's interesting as an early reader of her to see her work as it shifts. I'm not going to talk too much about this one because Brynn and I are going to do an episode for Book to Screen on Daisy Jones and the Six. It was recently released as an Amazon Prime, I think, TV show. So check back for more of my thoughts on that. But if you are living under a rock, Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid is about the whirlwind rise of a rock band in like the 70s. And originally the band was like five dudes and a key player that was a girl. Either way, it was six people. They made an album, they toured, and then they ended up doing an album with a separate singer, this woman that comes in as like a co-lead singer or whatever. But so the novel is written as an oral history of their time as a band and their infamous breakup. It's super interesting so far. I really like it. It is easy to see this one being not as one that like possibly isn't living up to its talk about it. But I think it really does hold up actually. It is actually a really good novel and is not necessarily as problematic as some people feel her other novels are. Anyways, we'll get into that more when we do the episode. But if you like Fleetwood Mac, if you like The Civil Wars, which is a band not everybody knows about, but if you like either of those bands, this book is interesting because those were the two influences for the story. The 70s rock band vibe, Fleetwood Mac adjacent, but the story is actually mostly inspired by the Civil Wars, which iconically broke up in the middle of a tour. Anyways, we'll talk more about that one on Brynn's episode, but I'm reading that one, really enjoying it. It reads pretty quickly. The last one I'm currently reading, on in ebook format, and it is called Disfigured: On Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space. It is by Amanda Leduc. L-E-D-U-C. Again, that's Disfigured: On Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space. It is about those three things, the intersection of disability and fairy tales, but it's basically the idea that like fairy tales are the foundational myths of our culture, our society. So how can a girl with a disability ever think she'll ever have a happy ending is sort of the blurb. I am reading this for a future episode. Brisa is coming back. I don't know if it'll get out in July, but we wanted to recognize July as Disability Pride Month. And so we're going to talk about this book in connection with another book whose name I have blanked on, but I haven't read it yet. So check back for that one. This one's really cool because it's got this like type of book always checks all my boxes because it's like a little bit academic, but not like so academic that it reads like a textbook. And it is sort of weaving together commentary on two things that do not have a lot of commentary written on them. Like there's not actually a lot of academic scholarship on fairy tales and disability, which is surprising, but I'm excited to get further into this one. I'm only like 2 chapters in, or the introduction in the chapter, not sure. Anyways, that was Disfigured on Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space. Okay, so now let's jump into the actual content of the episode. Well, you know, that was content too, but the main content of the episode, which is what I've been reading lately. So this is just a really long episode of books that you might enjoy because I've enjoyed them, and I'm going to tell you why I enjoyed them or I didn't enjoy them. So the first book I want to talk about is Six of Crows. I talked a little bit about this episode when I was... I talked a little bit about this book on previous episodes as I was reading through it. And I'm not going to talk about this book a lot because I think in a future episode, I'm hoping to do a book to screen episode on the TV adaptation of Leigh Bardugo's Fantasy World, who's the name of Shadowhunter. That's not a thing. That's a different TV show. Wow. Anyways, Leigh Bardugo's series. I'm really blanking on the rest of the series, y'all. Six of Crows and its sequel, Crooked Kingdom, is a duology that is set in the same universe as the original series that I'm going to look up right now because it is literally driving me crazy. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but Grishaverse, that's what it is. The Grishaverse is what her fantasy world is, but Shadow and Bone is the original trilogy, and they made a TV show. Netflix made a TV show about it, but they also tied in some of Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom, despite that those stories are set 200 years apart. But, you know, they probably didn't ask anybody who actually liked the books and read them. Or, as my coworker and I have discussed, everyone knows that everyone likes Six of Crows better, and so they knew everyone just wanted to get to that. Anyways, point of this is I'm not going to talk a ton about Six of Crows because I'm hoping that in a future episode I can do a book-to-screen conversation about the Grishaverse. And so Six of Crows is a part of that, and I will talk more in depth about that on a future episode. And I know I keep saying that, but I really will, so come back. Plus, I feel like, not that my opinion will change, but that my opinion will be more fully formed once I read Crooked Kingdom, which is the sequel to Six of Crows. Either way, rated this book 5 stars. I should start off with telling you, should have probably started off with telling you what my rating system is like, because everyone's is so different and so subjective, but I don't really believe in rating systems for that reason. I made one up because the book journal that I use, and every book journal I've ever seen, if you use a pre-made one, ask you to rate the book. And I got tired of seeing it and not filling it in, which is what I used to do. So I just made my own up. I don't have anything for 1 and 2 because if I feel 1 and 2 stars just means I stopped reading it, basically. So those don't ever end up in my book journal. But so for 3 stars, that means I probably won't reread the title, but I didn't hate it. I might recommend it depending on the context. 4 stars means I really liked it. I probably will recommend it. I probably will reread it. 5 stars is super loved it. One of my all-time faves. Will definitely reread it and will recommend it. So for Six of Crows, I rated it 5 stars. I absolutely loved it. I will reread it and I will recommend it. Are there more extended, that's not the word I want. Are there more involved fantasy novels with like more intricate world building? Sure. Are there more diverse fantasy cast? Sure. But this book was pure joy for me. I laughed. I got a little emotional. I read it obsessively until I got to the end. I made a lot of funny commentary because I was reading it in a physical book and I like to annotate my books when I read physical. Not like fancy annotations, just like underlining things and writing funny comments in the margins. Sometimes I write serious comments, but with Six of Crows, it was all mostly funny. If you are unfamiliar with Six of Crows, it is set in the world of the Grishaverse, which is just a fantasy world made up by Leigh Bardugo, and it is set in the town, village, area, country, I don't really know. It's called Ketterdam, though. It's like a sea hub. God, I'm so bad. I can't believe y'all listen to a podcast by me. It is, there are always boats coming into it, whatever that's called, and it's like a hub for international trade. And so Port City, that's what it's called, Port City. There are a bunch of criminals around everywhere. And so there is a, this book is a heist novel, and I fucking love a heist novel. This book's little blurb is, six dangerous outcasts, one impossible heist. Kaz's crew is the only thing that might stand between the world and destruction if they don't kill each other first. I just love the blurb on this. It talks about the six people. Says a convict with a thirst for revenge, a sharpshooter who can't walk away from a wager, a runaway with a privileged past, a spy known as the Wraith, a heartrender using her magic to survive the slums, and a thief with a gift for unlikely escapes. Like I said, love a heist novel. Was here for every moment of this. This was a heist novel with like layers of trauma woven through, which I am here for. All these characters had some form of trauma, which I feel like made them more like real people. And it's a YA novel, so it doesn't like go super in depth to the trauma aspect, but they all sort of end up where they are because of trauma. And I really liked the way that Bardugo talks about trauma and talks about people's experiences with certain types of trauma in this story. Each character also has some sort of disability or significant trauma that they're dealing with. One of them 100% has ADHD and deals with impulsive gambling, has a gambling addiction because of it. That's the other thing with this. None of them are like diagnosed on the page. Like no one says Jesper has ADHD, but as someone with ADHD who read Jesper on the page, there's no way he doesn't have ADHD. But he's a gambling addict. And so you can see that like impulsiveness come from the ADHD. That's not the only reason I think he's ADHD, but that's a big part of it. There's one of the characters is dyslexic. One of the characters has PTSD. Two of the characters, I would say, have PTSD. One of them has a disability. Like the main guy has a disability, which I love. I'm so here for seeing positive representation. I forgot the word. Positive representation of disability in a book. I've talked about that before on various episodes of this podcast. But he walks with a limp and uses a cane. And anyways, my book journal for this one I wrote. So my book journal is divided up into plot notes, character notes, favorite quotes, and other books by this author to read by this author. I just wrote for plot notes. Fucking loved every minute of this story. For character notes, I wrote, I want to adopt them all. And my favorite quote from this was, I like it when men beg, which is such a fun quote. So you should read the book to find the context of that. I'm just going to leave it at that. Okay, so we're going to move on to some of these I'm going to run through pretty quickly. I probably won't wax poetically about every one of them like I did Six of Crows, which is hilarious because I said I wasn't even going to say that much about it. You should always not believe me. Just assume I'm lying if I say I'm going to not talk about something a lot. Even when I decide to not talk about something for a lot, I just talk a lot in general. So the next book was Gender Queer, which is a graphic novel memoir by Maya Kobabe. I think is how you pronounce her last name. You've probably seen this one around a lot, especially for Pride Month last month. It is a graphic novel. Sorry, my notes are all out of order. I was trying to find the right one. I've gotten my, oh, I didn't even put, this is how great I am at prepping. I made notes, but I apparently left Genderqueer off of them. But it is a graphic novel memoir that tells the story of the author's experience, like processing and coming, like realizing that they were non-binary. And so I think this was a really powerful story. I like that it is a graphic novel. It makes it very accessible to a lot of people, but I don't know. This was just a really fascinating story. This was our book club, one of my book club books picks for this past month. And I actually missed that meeting. And I'm really sad because it sounded like there was a great conversation. But that, I think this is a great book to help anyone understand more about being non-binary, what the process is like when you realize it and you live like it and you, or you live your life trying to figure out how to reflect that, how to live true to yourself, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Anyways, like I said, I'm really bummed I missed this conversation at book club because I really enjoyed this book. I read it really quickly. I think I read it in like 2 hours. This is a book I really enjoyed. It was really powerful. I may read it again at some point in the future. I do that sometimes with graphic novels, but not as frequently as I do with regular novels. But I highly recommend this. This book is unfortunately being banned and challenged pretty much everywhere. It, because of its, what they're saying, sexual content, a lot of it is really just because it's queer, which we all know is what gets people the most riled up these days. But as a public librarian, I was really proud to buy this and put it on the shelf and have it accessible for teens and young adults who are going through this similar thing in their own lives. And I think having a book, a graphic novel or a piece of literature that reflects what you're dealing with in your own life is so powerful and so important, and helps, like, honestly save lives. And so I think this is one of those that, like, does that significantly. If you have a local library that you are familiar with, or if you're not, go find it. I would highly suggest checking this out. Even if you've already read it, give some support for it. And also check in on your public librarians after Pride Month. A lot of us are not okay. We are fighting every day to make sure that there are inclusive programming and displays out there, not solely limited to Pride Month, but that's the one that tends to be targeted the most. So anyways, that was Gender Queer, a memoir by Maya Kobabe. Kobabe, I don't know how you say it. It really looks like Kobabe, which just makes me really happy. And I don't think that's probably the correct pronunciation, but either way, it was great. It was Kobabe. But Gender Queer, a memoir, or the graphic novel, we'll pull it up for you. Genderqueer is a term that is used, like a general term that is used, so make sure if you're looking for it, you're putting in the word memoir or graphic novel, and that'll help you find it quicker. Okay, speaking of Pride Month and queer books, the next book is also a queer book. This was for another book club that I did not get to go to. My car's been in the shop for like a month, so I've missed all my book clubs lately. But the next one is Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. This was also a reread, like Daisy Jones. I was like, what did I already say I'd reread this month? Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett was a reread for me. This book came out in like 2019, I think. Which I read it when it came out originally, and I really liked it, and I enjoyed it the second time around too. This time around, I did the audiobook. I've been on a like super big audiobook kick lately. I go through phases where sometimes I read them and or listen to them more. Sometimes I don't, but I did this one on audiobook the second time. Yeah, 2019. Okay, sorry, I was double checking. I did it on paper when it came out in 2019, and I read it on, listened to it on audio this time around. It is very character driven. The setting and the general plot is really interesting, but it is not action packed. So if that's not your cup of tea, you probably will not like this. It is very slow. I really liked it. I loved the character development. I thought the characters were very interesting, and I loved the commentary on grief and growing up and how families are fucked up. And as an adult, you have to learn how to navigate them in a completely different way. So this book is about the main character, Jessa, finds her father has committed suicide, and she's the one who finds the body. And so there's a lot of context and commentary on grief, and sort of being the person to try to hold everything together. Her dad was a taxidermist. He owned a shop, and she had learned how to do it growing up and helped him, and so she takes over the shop. But also there is this very tangled other aspect of the story where she, Jessa, is in love with her best friend from growing up, who married her brother. So she was having an affair with her brother's wife, but Bren, the wife, was Jessa's best friend growing up, and like they had had sort of a relationship before Bren married her brother. So it's a very tangled web that has been woven, but it's a great story. I really, really liked the commentary on families and how you think you know someone in your family, but you don't really, especially if you are thinking of, like, if it's your parent, like, you know, you think you know them as a kid and then you grow up and you realize that there are so many other layers to them as a person, versus just being your parent. So I really liked that commentary. And I really liked the context of Jessa as like the sibling who has to hold everything or the person in general has to hold everything together after her dad dies and her brother's wife leaves. She like leaves her husband and kids, and like no one's seen her or heard from her for a while. And so Jessa is told by her father in the letter he leaves, and also just sort of as it goes with the oldest daughter, decides or feels like she has to hold everything together, hold everyone else together. As the oldest daughter and someone who lived as the oldest child for a long time, I resonated with this deeply. I did not expect to be called out like that. Don't appreciate it. It's a great story. I really think that unless you're someone who needs a lot of action in their books, I think the story is, even if you don't love it, is a very interesting story to read. My favorite quote from it was, "To need meant to be vulnerable. It was one of the scariest things I could imagine. Needing anything meant you were open to invasion. It meant you had no control over yourself." I just thought that was fascinating and a different way to look at relying on other people, which is something I'm very bad at doing. So I resonated with this quote very much. Okay. The next book I want to talk about is one I talked about in my little mini summer reading guide. It is called Dyscalculia, A Love Story of Epic Miscalculation. The author's last name is Felix, but Dyscalculia will pull it up for you. There aren't very many books called that. It is this beautiful pink book. It's very small. It's a very quick read. It is not written in poetry, but it reads as fast as like a novel in verse would. It's a book of essays. Well, guess it's considered a book of essays. I'm not really sure. It's like a lot of shorter chapters, one page mini essays sort of deal. But it's about the author's experience going through this huge breakup that like accumulates in a hospital stay, and where she like throughout the book, like it's a reflection on her processing early childhood trauma and her mental health, which has never been properly diagnosed or treated. And the dyscalculia comes in as a form of like so dyscalculia, if you are unfamiliar with the term, is like dyslexia, but it's for math. So if someone has dyscalculia, they don't, like they can't understand math. It's really difficult to learn math and use math. And so the author uses this as like a metaphor for the consequences of her miscalculations in love. And so a lot of this book comes, like she comes at this book through the lens of her romantic relationships, but it's a lot of talk about her trauma and her mental health, and how she, I was going to say I don't want to spoil it, but it's a memoir, so you're not really spoiling much, but it's fascinating because she, as a kid, like growing up, is like a bunch of people try to diagnose or treat her for certain different things. But one of the diagnoses that comes up is dyscalculia because she cannot grasp math. She cannot understand it. And she's failing at it when she's not failing at everything else in her life or in her school. And so dyscalculia gets tossed around a lot, but then she realizes Once she's properly diagnosed towards the end of the novel and she's treated for her proper diagnosis, that she can actually understand math. And so she doesn't really have dyscalculia. She has, you know, that inability to understand and learn math was sort of a symptom of a bigger picture that was not being properly diagnosed. And I just thought that was fascinating. As a someone who has dealt with various symptoms, both mentally and physically, of things that have a lot of... So the things that I deal with, fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain disorder that has many, many symptom overlaps with many, many other disorders and does not have a positive... or doesn't have a way to positively identify it as a diagnosis of exclusion. And then I also deal with anxiety, depression, and ADHD, and all three of those things have a lot of overlap. And so, especially with the ADHD, like, a lot of women don't get diagnosed we're seeing right now, like, a lot of women in their 30s are getting diagnosed now, and it wasn't caught when they were growing up, because a lot of the symptoms of ADHD in women present as depression and anxiety related symptoms. But also, the symptoms of anxiety, depression, ADHD, and fibro all overlap into this big, muddled, murky cloud of symptoms. And so this dyscalculia book was really interesting to see the way that something that they thought was a disorder was actually just a symptom of a larger problem that was being improperly diagnosed. This book is not about, like, it's not actually about her having dyscalculia or, like, her struggle with math. Like, it is used as a metaphor. She talks about her actual difficulty learning math, but that's, like, not the focus of the book, which I can see some people getting confused about. So, but I really liked how it was sort of a meditation on loving yourself in the face of heartbreak and loving yourself while you're on this journey to find a proper diagnosis for your mental health, or you're navigating these very scary symptoms of mental health disorders. That's a really hard thing to do. Both of those things are really hard to do, loving yourself in the face of heartbreak or in the face of these overwhelming mental health disorders. I have, unfortunately, a personal experience with both those things. And so I really loved the beautiful way that this book meditates on that. It's a really powerful way, or powerful look at the way that mental health controls your life and what it's like to take your life back once you start to heal or get proper treatment. But yeah, I really like this. I had never read anything by this author. They have a previous book called Build Yourself a Boat, but I had never heard of it. So I'm going to go read that soon. I don't know if it's a memoir too. Let's find out. You're on this journey with me. It is a poetic exploration of trauma, healing, and survival. So probably similar to what Dyscalculia was, but cool. Looking forward to reading that one. But yes, so that book was Dyscalculia, a love story of epic miscalculation. And the author's last name is Felix. So the next book I want to talk about is The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which is a book that everyone and their mother is talking about. And so I thought I'd throw my two cents in. As previously stated, love Taylor Jenkins Reid. So The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo was the first book in this shift of writing style that Taylor Jenkins Reid has. So she published these first four books in a kind of normal, they were stories about normal people, like everyday life stories, fiction, like they're novels. But they're told in normal novel format. And then The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo is the first one that she published in this sort of oral history interview style format. And is the first that she has, that she published about someone who is supposed to be famous. And so there are sort of background characters in this novel that show up in the subsequent novels, even though they're not directly connected. She's written all the novels she wrote after The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo are about someone who is famous or is somehow related to a life of celebrity, like their dad's famous or their partner's famous or something like that. And so even though Seven Husbands is a standalone, Daisy Jones is a standalone, they all sort of tie in together. They have characters that overlap a little bit, not like in a big way, but Anyways, this was sort of the first in that collection of novels that she's been writing lately. And if you are unfamiliar with it, it is, which again, you kind of have to be living under a rock to not know anything about Taylor Jenkins Reid right now, if you live in the book world, especially if you work in the book world. But Evelyn Hugo is about this old school Hollywood movie icon who is like in her late 80s, I think, and she is, she does this sort of tell-all, what she sort of says is an interview for a magazine, but like when the writer gets there, she's like, no, actually, I want this to be a tell-all book that you publish about me once I'm dead. But so it's a tell-all about Evelyn's life, about a lot of the things that she never talked about during her years as a movie star. Set in Los Angeles in like the 50s to 80s, and it is told, like the interview, like, or not the interview, the book is told in the format of an interview, but it is broken down into, instead of like chapters per se, it is broken down into the stories of the seven husbands, which is where the title comes from, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. I really enjoyed this book. I think this is where Taylor Jenkins Reid starts to get some criticism for writing characters that are not own voices characters. So the main character, Evelyn Hugo, in this story is Latina, and Taylor Jenkins Reid is white. And so, and then the other main character in this novel, the reporter, is half black. And so there's a lot of commentary around, sort of critical commentary around Taylor Jenkins Reid writing characters of color as a white woman. Also, Evelyn Hugo is bisexual, and several of the other main characters in this story are gay. And so I don't think that Taylor Jenkins Reid has ever commented on her sexual orientation. And own voices is such a tricky thing when you get into things like sexual orientation or disability, because those things are not visible. Those things are not always, you know, someone can be straight presenting but actually be queer, as Evelyn Hugo was a lot in this book. But either way, this was a great, I feel like was a great, was great by representation. Evelyn Hugo, like, it's sort of, she's never announced or come out. And so this is sort of the first time that she's coming out. She loved a woman most of her adult life, but it was never, they were never public, so to speak, because it was like the 50s to 80s. And so it would have ruined careers, that sort of thing. And so it's, like I said, the story is told from the perspective of telling the stories of Evelyn's life through the lens of her seven husbands. And so it was really interesting to see the way that people can love differently. Like, each relationship can evolve in a different way and is not necessarily true love or like soulmate level. There's only like, she doesn't, well, also the thing I really love about Evelyn Hugo is she doesn't regret things. And so she's very bold about that and about what she wants and what she has sort of a ruthless ambition. And so she, like, as she sort of spins these tales of the seven husbands, she talks about how she learned to sort of channel her ambition in a still ruthless way, but in a way that hurt less people, I guess. Or did not hurt unintentionally or unknowingly. She was very aware, like, she becomes very aware of what her ambition does and what that looks like. Anyways, I thought it was really interesting. I liked the way it was structured, the lens of the seven husbands. I really liked the reporter story being woven in. I'm not going to talk about that too much because it'll spoil the story. But I really liked, you see throughout her interviewing Evelyn, you see the reporter learn how to stand up for herself and to she learns to take what she wants for herself. And she sort of learns a little bit of that ruthless ambition from, like, a little bit of it sort of rubs off on her from Evelyn. I just thought that was really cool. It is being made into a movie. I don't know if I'll watch it. Sometimes I want I always want to watch movies that are made from books, and sometimes I don't because I'm afraid it will ruin my experience reading the book. This is something we sort of talk about a little bit in our book to movie episode that I did with Britton, and what we'll probably talk a little bit about each time we do a book to screen episode. But I'm having to learn to separate the two very different art forms. Novels and movies are very different art forms. And so, I don't know, a lot of people were really gunning for this to be picked up by HBO or Showtime. It was picked up by Hulu. So I don't think it's going to be quite the production that a lot of people wanted, but we'll see. Taylor Jenkins Reid is just rolling in movie / screen adaptations for her books. One of her early novels got also recently made into a movie. Was it Maybe in Another Life? I think it might have been Maybe in Another Life. No, it was One True Loves. No, it was Forever Interrupted, right? Who knows? Listen, one of her other early, one of the big four, Forever Interrupted. It was Forever Interrupted, right? No, it wasn't. I'm sorry, y'all. I should edit this out, but I'm not going to. It wasn't Forever Interrupted. Forever Interrupted is the one that I've yet to read because when I started reading it, I was on my honeymoon and didn't realize that it's actually about a newlywed woman whose husband is hit by a bus and like killed right after they're married. So I was like, you know, this is not the time, and I haven't gone back. It's One True Loves. One True Loves recently also got made into a movie, and Daisy Jones is a TV show. Seven Husbands is going to be a movie, and if I am not mistaken, they are making Carrie Soto's back and Malibu Rising into either TV shows or movies. So there's a lot to consume content-wise if you are a Taylor Jenkins Reid fan. I used to say she was one of my favorites. I don't know if that's true anymore. I think I'm seeing my reading taste shift a little. I do really enjoy them. Daisy Jones is incredible. I really loved After I Do. I think it's a really interesting way to look at a love story. That's the thing I like about her. She takes a traditional love story and sort of turns it on its head. But anyways, so that was Evelyn Hugo. I really liked it. I rated it a 3-star though, which, let me flip back to my little rating system that I keep in the beginning of my book journal because I just made it up and I don't use it outside of this journal. So I probably won't reread it, but I didn't hate it, and I might recommend it depending on the context. Okay, I've got 4 books left. I'm going to talk about them out of order a little bit, only by like a couple days. So I have been on vacation for about a week now, a little less than a week now, and I still have 3 days. 3 more days of vacation. So I've been reading a lot, and I've been doing a lot of audiobook while I crochet, and I listen to audiobooks very fast because I have ADHD. I always get a lot of looks when I admit to how fast I listen to an audiobook, but I listen to an audiobook almost always on 2-point speed. So double like regular speed. A lot of people listen at like 1.5 or maybe 1.75. I listen at 2.0. I have ADHD, so I listen to audiobooks fast. My brain processes them like normal. I talk fast, I listen, I read fast. So I did most of Seven Husbands on audio and really liked it. I finished it in paperback because I was getting impatient. Sometimes I feel like even though I listen to books on fast speed, I can actually read faster. So I often go back and forth between formats depending on what I'm doing. So I'm going to talk about another book. I think I have 4 books left. All of them were ones I did on audio. And so this next one is also another one from my mini summer reading guide. It's called Wayward by Amelia Hart. It is sort of partially historical fiction. It's got fantasy aspects to it. There's magic. It's sort of more magical realism, I guess, than like full fantasy. But It weaves together the stories of three women across five centuries. So there's a story set in 1619, sort of the matriarch of the story, the earliest woman in this family that you meet. She is put on trial for witchcraft. Her mother taught her their magic, which is not rooted in spell casting, but is rooted in the deep knowledge of the natural world, which is an aspect of this novel that I loved. I love the magic systems based on like the natural world. And so that was a really interesting aspect for me. But she's unusual. She's a healer. And so obviously she is accused of witchcraft. This was in the early days of the witch trials. Obviously people before this had been burned at the stake or killed for being a witch, but accused of being a witch. But this was sort of in its heyday. But so there's that storyline. And then there's the storyline of in 1942 of the daughter of a super wealthy man. It's set during the Second World War. The main character's name is Violet. Her name is Violet. She sort of lives in, you know, this time where societal convention says that girls and women can only look a certain way and do certain things. And so she loves being outside. She loves nature. She loves animals. And she has a little bit of magic that she doesn't realize until she is sort of isolated. She's sort of sent away to live in. She doesn't know anything about her mother. And so she ends up getting sent away to this cottage in the middle of the woods that actually used to belong to her mother. Her mother was one of the wayward women. We don't actually technically get her mother's story. It's not like an official timeline, but we do get a lot of her story, and it's very interesting. And then the third timeline you get is 2019. It is Kate, who is fleeing to this cottage that she inherited from her great aunt Violet that she barely remembers, only met once or twice, but she is fleeing an abusive marriage or abusive relationship. And so she sort of uncovers this family secret of magic and witch hunts and connection to nature, that sort of thing, through her stay in this cottage as she tries to rebuild her life. I was really curious about how I would process this book, if I would be able to process this book. I often don't do well with multiple timelines or character perspectives. And so this was three timelines and this was three characters, but I think because while there was a uniform storyline, like a uniform connection, the majority of this book was three entirely separate storylines and perspectives. They didn't, like, the generations were so far apart that they weren't, like, even though Violet and Kate lived at the same time, Kate was so young. The only time she met Violet, and they didn't have a relationship when Kate was an adult, so there wasn't really any crossover there. So I was able to keep them straight in that sense. And I really liked the way that the audiobook did this. I can't remember if this was more than one narrator or not. I think it was. I think there was a separate narrator for each timeline, each perspective, which I normally, again, would hate, but this one was done really well, and I really liked it. Yeah, so there's a separate narrator for each of the three main characters. Kate, Violet, and Altha was the 1619 character. But this is a really beautiful story about the power of women, the resilience of women, and of family, like the women in a family, way that like a matriarchal knowledge is passed down. And I really loved the way the stories were woven together, even though they were separate. Yeah, so that one was really good. It's fairly new. It was published this year. I own it in hardback, but I listened to it on audio, which is the story of most of these books. I didn't listen to Six of Crows on audio. I did not. So I read that one I read Genderqueer in paperback. I own a physical copy of Mostly Dead Things, The Seven Husbands, The Collected Regrets of Clover, which I haven't talked about yet, Wayward, and Under the Whispering Door, which I haven't talked about yet. I own physical copies of all of those, and I read them all, or did them all on audio. So that's how life's been lately. Thankfully, I'm not buying multiple formats. I get advanced listener copies through Libro.fm, and then I do my library audiobooks and ebooks. Which, let me take a quick second to talk both Libro.fm and your library up for audiobooks. Libro.fm is a great option for audiobooks. It works the way that Audible does, with some very important differences. But if you're familiar with the Audible sort of structure, where you pay a monthly fee and you get one credit, and then you get a discount on anything else you buy after that, Libro.fm works the same way, but you actually own the files that you purchase. So, and a lot of people don't know this, but Audible can, in theory, take away your books at any point, because you don't technically own them. And then also, with Libro.fm, my favorite part about it is that you can pick which bookstore you want to support. So they support indie bookshops. So like, I have Avid selected as my bookshop. I believe if you don't have a specific one, you can just sort of choose to where it divides it out, however, like between different ones or something like that. But it's really cool. Sign up for a subscription. The basic subscription is one book, $15 a month. Gets you the one credit. You use a credit to buy a book. And then you get a discount on, any like purchases after that. So if I used my one credit and I still want to buy another audiobook, I can buy it at a discounted price, which I really like. I've never done that, mostly because even with the discounted price, it's a lot of money. Audiobooks are really expensive, and so one of the cheaper ways to get it is to do a program like Libro.fm, where you get $15 for the first one. Without any sort of discount, I think most of them are $35 to $50, depending on how long they are. Libro.fm gives you, I think, 30% off any other like purchases afterwards. You can also like just purchase books without a membership, or you can do credit bundles where you purchase like 5 credits at a time, something like that. Yeah, you get 30% off. If you're a member, you get one credit a month, and you get 30% off any audiobook purchases. You can put your membership on hold at any time. I do this a lot. You don't lose your audiobooks or any unused credits, which I think is a different story than Audible. Also, Audible is owned by the big bad Amazon, and so if you like doing audiobooks but you don't want to give Audible your money, or you don't want to give Amazon your money, which I recommend not doing whenever possible, you can do it through Libro.fm. Sorry, this episode's really rambly today. I keep forgetting kind of what I'm talking about in the middle of what I'm doing. I think it's a symptom of being on vacation for so long. I just haven't been around other people. I haven't been having conversations outside of those with my husband. And he's been working, so I've just been listening to people talk to me instead of talking to people. I was also trying to find my Libro.fm. It's Libro.fm, by the way. I was trying to find my referral code, but I'll make sure that's posted in the Instagram. There is a referral code where you get a discount if you use it. And so I did most of my books either through Libro. Oh, so Libro.fm offers, if you're a librarian or a bookseller, you can get advanced listening copies. If you're a librarian, unfortunately, you have to have an ALA membership number, which I think is really dumb. But at one point I had one. I don't think I'm currently up to date in my ALA membership, but I had it at one point. So it like let me sign up, and then now I get free audiobooks. So a lot of these I sort of had sitting there, and if I wasn't using Libro.fm, if you don't want to purchase it, if you're not a librarian or a bookseller where you would get free advanced listening copies, your library is your best friend. Your library most likely has a audiobook ebook option. It's typically through the Libby app, L-I-B-B-Y. I would call your librarian and ask for information if you are interested, because every library is different in the way you sign up. But basically, you borrow audiobooks and ebooks the same way you would a regular book. You just do it on an app through your phone, through an app on your phone. And so I did a lot of those this way, including, no, Wayward was an advanced listening copy. I did mostly Dead Things as a library audiobook. And that is also how I'm doing Sabrina and Karina. It is also how I did the next book I'm going to talk about, Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka. I did this book because it was my staff book club book, and I enjoyed it on audio. I think I would have hated it in paper format. It is very short, but it's a National Book Award finalist too. It's really good. It's really powerful. So it is about the lives of women who are sort of mail order brides from Japan, and they leave Japan and they go to San Francisco, where they marry people who are different people than the ones that they thought they were marrying at the time. And it talks about their experience as being Japanese and living in America, raising Japanese American children. But it is set during Second World War, where it was really dangerous to be Japanese in America. This is a time period that a lot of history classes don't cover and a lot of people don't know about, but there was a time during the Second World War that we had sort of, we made all of, our president made all of the Japanese immigrants move into these sort of camps. They weren't as dangerous, so to speak, as concentration camps, but they were sort of prison camps. They were not given a choice to be there. They were not given a choice about when they could leave. They lost their properties. They lost a lot of their family. They lost all of their belongings when they moved into these camps. And so this book is about Japanese women's journey from leaving their home country to becoming immigrants in America and then being put in these camps and sort of how that looked in their life. The book is separated into 8 parts. I'm trying to flip through the physical copy because I did a audiobook copy, like I said. But it's written in sort of a, I saw someone on Goodreads call it a glorified bullet point list, and that does kind of feel like what it is. There is a collective narrator. It's not one specific narrator. So it goes from, there's a couple parts about their journey over on the boat, and then there's a couple parts about their marriage and the relationships with the husbands. There are sections on being mothers, and then there are, and raising Japanese American children, and then there are a couple sections on the camps. And so it was really short but really powerful, I think. The audiobook was 4 hours, I think, in regular people time. The way it was written, the way the collective narrator setup worked, is it made it sound like this story was told from what seemed like both one woman and many different women at the same time, because the shared experience was so strong. But it did have some separation. But anyways, it was really interesting. It was really powerful. It's very short. The physical copy is 130 pages. So like I said, very short. It is apparently a follow-up to When the Emperor Was Divine, which was also about the experience of Japanese immigrants in America during the Second World War. But I think it focuses, that entire book, I think, focuses on life in the camps. Anyways, I don't think it's a direct sequel. I have not read When the Emperor Was Divine, and I was not, did not feel like I was missing anything. I'm going to go back and read that one, but reading this one on its own felt fine. Okay, the last two books I want to talk about, I wanted to talk about together because they have similar themes, and the way that I interacted with them was very similar. I'm probably going to get emotional during this part, so forgive me in advance, or I apologize in advance. The books are Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Klune and The Collected Regrets of Clover by Mickey Brommer. So The Collected Regrets of Clover is about a woman who works as a death doula, and she experiences death for the first time as a very young child. Her first grade teacher, I think, sort of dies, has a heart attack in the middle of reading Peter Rabbit, I think is what it is, sort of the setup. So she's experienced death really young and sort of, instead of running from it, like wants to understand it more. So she feels like she has a stronger connection with the dying than she does with the living. And the book is sort of about the, like the tagline is, what's the point of giving someone a beautiful death if you can't give yourself a beautiful life? And so she spends so much time with her work as a death doula that she doesn't really have much of a life herself. If you don't know what a death doula is, it is just someone who sits with people as they die and helps make their last bit of time, however long that may be, comfortable. She helps them wrap up any loose ends. She helps them prepare wills or come up with plans for their funerals, helps them reconnect with anybody that they like want to before they pass away, and just in general sort of offers them company. A lot of people that she does this for don't have any other family or friends to sit with them. And so she's raised by her grandfather, and her grandfather passed away, died alone while she was traveling in another country in college. So she sort of becomes a death doula as a way to make up for that. She sits with people and helps usher them into peacefully through their end of life process, because she wasn't able to do that for her grandfather. I loved this book. I was not sure how I was going to feel about this book. So for context, last Thursday was the 1 year anniversary of one of my best friends passing away, and this Thursday is his birthday. And so I have been processing a lot of grief for the past year, and one of the ways that I best process things is through reading. And so I had Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Klune. I'd owned for a while. It came out a little bit ago, and I loved his first, not his first book, but his previous book, The House in the Cerulean Sea. And I knew I would really like this one, but I sort of put it on the shelf for a later date because of the theme of grief. And so I pulled it out this week. I got The Collected Regrets. It's a more recent publication. I had a hard copy that I picked up somewhere, and then I got an advanced listening copy. And so it sounded very interesting and like something I wanted to read, but I knew that I was going to have a lot of feelings when I read it. And so I kind of took this week, I took this past week off, and so I sort of saved these two books for this week when I would have a lot of time to cry while I read them and also process any feelings of my own grief that came up through that. So The Collected Regrets of Clover is this beautiful story of Clover sitting with, for jobs, is this feisty old woman, and Clover goes on sort of a mini trip to uncover a forgotten love story for the woman she's working with, and surprise, she finds her own happy ending, which feels a little saccharine, but I don't even know if that's how that word is pronounced. Don't you love being a reader, and so you only know how you only think you know how to pronounce words because you've read them so many times, but you've never actually heard them said out loud until you say it out loud. But it sounds very like almost cheesy. When I read the cover, back cover, flip cover, inside cover, whatever it is now, with the little summary. But the commentary on grief was so beautiful. The commentary on healing was so beautiful. I particularly liked, in both of these stories actually, really liked and appreciated the commentary in the context of the guilt that the living are left with. So for those of us still living, the sort of guilt that we carry about not being close enough, not talking enough, not being there when someone passed away, not realizing how much they meant to you until after they were gone, that sort of thing. I really appreciated the thread of that through both of these books, and in Collected Regrets, you see that in the way she massively regrets not physically being there when her grandfather passes away. She was raised by her grandfather, so it's like her closest person. And so that was really interesting. It was exactly the book, right book at the right time for me. So that was really, it was really comforting. I also really liked, the thing I really, really liked about this book is that there's a lot of talk about the timeline of grief and how a lot of our culture and society thinks that you should be over grief relatively quickly, or there's a specific timeline depending on who died. And so this book sort of tackles that and in a way that announces that there is no real timeline for grief, that we are always grieving. There's a quote in it: grief, I'd come to realize, was like dust. When you're in the thick of a dust storm, you're completely disoriented by the onslaught, struggling to see or breathe. But as the force recedes and you slowly find your bearing and see a path forward, the dust begins to settle into the crevices. It will never disappear completely. As the years pass, you will find it in unexpected places at unexpected moments. I thought that was so beautiful and so, like, true to my own experience. I think a lot of people don't understand the gravity of what losing a close friend does to you. I think when we look at the death of someone, we think about their parents or their spouses or their immediate families, but there is this toll that it takes on the friends, the close friends of the person who has passed, and there's no expected timeline for anyone, but especially for, like, there's not a lot of talk in our culture about dealing with grief as a friend. And so I was really comforted and reassured by the sort of timeline conversation in this book. But so that was The Collected Regrets of Clover by Mickey Brommer. And then the other book that I talked a little bit about in that conversation, and the last one I want to talk about today, is called Under the Whispering Door by T.J. Klune. A lot of you may know T.J. Klune from his previous book, The House in the Cerulean Sea, which was also very lovely and made me cry too, though not as much as this one did. One of my notes in my book journal for Under the Whispering Door was, this book made me cry in a lot of different ways, which is annoying, but was also super cathartic. And I think it is an emotional book in general. And if you're super sensitive or you cry a lot or you cry easily, especially in books, then you might cry. I think I cried specifically because of the context of my own life. But this book tells the story of Wallace, who dies and wakes up at his own funeral. And so it sort of is after death. The tagline is, I can see it in my head on the cover of the book. I'll find it in a second. But Under the Whispering Door is about what happens after you die. And for some people, they need help crossing over peacefully. And so that's what the main plot of this book is about. Oh, the tagline is death is only their beginning. So Wallace wakes up at his own funeral, realizes he's dead, and then is collected by a reaper and is taken back to a tea shop where he meets lovely people, some of whom are ghosts and some are who are human. But he learns to live, sort of. He realizes what a terrible person he's been, basically, and tries to learn to live a different way. This book was really funny and really uplifting, but also emotional and really healing for me personally as I process my grief. But I highly suggest it for anyone. The sort of basic idea of this plot wasn't super new, but the execution was done so well. The execution was a little different than the typical, I woke up and I'm dead and now I get to like decide if I'm gonna live a different life vibe. But T.J. Klune is such a great writer, and is a great writer and also a really great, he's really great at creating characters. I loved all of the characters in this one. I wanted to hug all of them. The main characters, Wallace and Hugo, had my heart from the very, very beginning. But anyways, can't recommend this one enough. There's some great quotes in this one. One of them was, it's not always the big deaths either. There are little deaths because that's what grief is. And then another one was, life is messy and terrible and wonderful all at the same time. And I just thought that was so true. A lot of times we try to see life in black and white, but it is actually very gray. And it can be beautiful and messy and terrible and wonderful all at the same time. And that's kind of how my own experience, especially in the past year, has been, especially with grief. Like, grief is really heavy and terrible and messy, but there are some really wonderful, beautiful moments that still happen in spite of and because of your grief. And so this book really touched on that a lot, I feel like. Okay, so those were all the books I wanted to talk about today. This is longer than I expected it to be, but again, I talk a lot, so you kind of know what you get, what you've signed up for if you've listened to any previous episodes. Thank you so much for listening. Please don't hesitate to check us out on Instagram. Message me if you would like to chat about today's episode or comment on the post that I will at some point post about it. Feel free to rate and review us if your podcast listening app allows you to do that. Check the Instagram's link tree for a Libro FM referral code that'll get you a discount. And don't forget to ask your local librarian about audiobooks. Thank you so much for listening today. Our Instagram is Tales from a Bibliophile. Forgot to say that. But anyways, thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you next week.